KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest writes all kinds of stuff. He's a novelist. He's a playwright. And certainly a very successful writer-director of film. His newest project is Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey, which a title that takes on more and more meaning as you watch the film and talk to David E. Talbert. David, first of all, thank you so much for being here.
Man, come on. How could I not be talking to a black man named Elvis? I mean, that is, in itself is why I showed up.
Either that or you lost a bet. But let's talk about the movie. And because what's really so interesting about this thing to me is just, we were talking about black excellence. And before we got started, you were telling me this story about going to see Black Panther with your son and how it started off as being what you expected to be one kind of experience and turned into something else.
Yeah, you know, I of course, was... found every piece of kente in the house, and like most black people, and I went there with my son to show him the pride of this film. And I'm sitting there, I got my popcorn, I'm watching it, and as it went on, I'm like, when they said, "Do you know who you are?" I'm like, "Well, I stopped being there for my son," and I'm like, "Well, what manner of excellence is this? I didn't expect everything that I got to move me as much as it moved my son in totally different ways." And I remember I went to my office in Universal that night. I went there that night and I was working on a script for another film, and I moved that script to the trash bin and I hit delete.
Wow.
Because I said, the level of excellence that I just saw, the script that I was about to do, that film inspired me that if Ryan Coogler pushed the envelope to put that level of excellence on the screen, then what the hell am I doing? And that's when I started putting the screws into Jingle Jangle. And I said, I'm going to throw everything in the kitchen sink into this to make sure that that bar is raised as high up in the sky as possible.
Well, I have to say, I mean, there's so much going on in this. In fact, one of the things I would say that really makes this actually a little bit closer to your novels than plays or movies you've done is that there is so much story in it. Any act of Jingle Jangle could be an entire movie in and of itself. And I was wondering, because we're talking about basically world building that Ryan did for Black Panther, if that was something you were concentrating on doing too, because we can sort of connect this to Almost Christmas, which is another movie about a broken family surrounded by a widower that comes together basically as a whole when they all get together. And that's kind of the heart of Jingle Jangle, but there's more than that too, isn't it?
This was an opportunity, the first ever for me, to explore people of color or to normalize, to bring a new aesthetic to holiday classics. Where Almost Christmas was for my audience. It was for people that look like me. And it succeeded in that. Jingle Jangle is for the world. It's adding an aesthetic to holiday canons, the classic holiday canons, where it's intentional in its representation, but it has nothing to do with color or race. It wears its heart and humanity in the forefront. That's what we lead with: heart, humanity, love, wonder, whimsy, just like the movies that I watched when I was growing up. And I wanted to put something out in the world that inspires the world, but gives people that representation to people in the canon of holiday classics.
It's so interesting too, because one of the things that's so much fun about it is to see, I have to say this, a black cast in that kind of heightened artificiality. You know, this could be The Shop Around the Corner or Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Well, that's what it was for me, is the images we have of black people in this era, there's a whip against our backs. That's it. You know, in the 1800s, that's all we show. But there were scientists, inventors around the world, even in this country. There were innovators. There were all of this brilliance that we don't get a chance to celebrate. And so it was important for me in this era when I showed a Black inventor, it was important for me to show the beauty of Africa. Also, the patterns in the wardrobe are mixed with Victorian patterns, with authentic patterns from Ghana are mixed in there, and the carvings on the walls. And we wanted to celebrate that because that's what it would be, and offer a new aesthetic. I don't want my son to just sit down and every time we're talking about this era of Black people that there's always a whip against our backs. I want him to see someone look like him soaring and flying and inventing and STEM and all that kind of stuff. I think it's important.
What's so much fun about the movie too, I think, David, is that there's kind of a classicism to it, you know? I mean, it's really formal in a lot of ways, that it's when we're where we're in the studio set. And it's interesting, you think about that. It's really rare to see people of color in a setting that's not almost ultra realistic. And just to sort of put that kind of fantasy world in it, or put people of color in a world that's specifically about visual fantasy, really changes our expectation. It kind of upends them as we're watching, doesn't it?
It does. You know, we are steeped in, as a culture, you know, one of the things, we keep it real. We show what we know. We write about what we experience on a daily basis. In a lot of the inner cities in Black America, what we experience isn't whimsy and wonder and magic. We experience a lot of the ills of what goes on in the neighborhood. But in the midst of that, there is joy. There is whimsy. There is wonder. There is laughter. There is love. There are all those things. But sometimes as artists, we lean on what is most prevalent. And so for me, I grew up in Montgomery County, which was a suburb of D.C., and I grew up in a prominently white area. And there were only two Black kids in the elementary school. And then I moved to Capitol Heights, which is, of course, densely Black. So I got a chance to experience life on the other side. I got a chance to experience a sense of innocence, and that you don't normally get as much as we would hope in the inner city. So for me, I wanted to be able to provide for my community and for the world community this whimsy and wonder. And I wanted for children of color all around the world to see that they have a seat at this table of wonder. And they can be, you don't have to be Harry Potter, you can be Larry Potter or Barry Potter or any of that. You know, it doesn't just, wonder and whimsy does not just land and belong to one culture.
My guest who just sent the chill through J.K. Rowling is David E. Talbert. His new film as writer director is Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey. And there's so much to talk about here about this movie, because first of all, the musical numbers, even though they go through all different genres and styles, have a kind of a gospel exaltation to them. And it's funny because I find myself thinking about this thing that runs through so much of your work, which is to basically set these dramas in a place of faith where there's a battle between faith and cynicism, which is also a lot of the Black struggle too, isn't it?
Well, I grew up in a Holiness church, Holiness storefront Pentecostal church. My great-grandmother was a pastor, and I would watch working class people through her words, Bible stories, through the word of God, change people's lives, touch people's lives, give joy. I'd see the old church sisters shouting in the pews and doing the holy dance. And so I got a chance to see that in the midst of what was going on, there was this balm, there was this hope, there was this promise of a better day. You know, we bought into that. And I think as a community, we still buy into that. But if we don't see images, then we don't know we can be. If we don't see it, how do you know you can be it? And cinema is such a powerful medium. And I think we have a responsibility to tell all kinds of stories and certainly give hope and show where you can push past pain to get through joy. That's who I am. That's what I grew up in, the stories that I was taught as a child in church. And that's the hope that I want to put out into the universe.
Well, I think it's there because I do think there is an aspect of, again, even I would say the store, Jingle Jangle store, is, especially with those risers and those balconies, kind of reminiscent of a church to me. And that first number is very much, even though it's doing so much stuff and it's basically conflating so many different types of culture and genre, it still feels like kind of a revival number about faith, about his faith, and then the rest of the movie is what he has to do to regain that faith.
Well, it's true. You know, when we introduce him, he's like in a pulpit of his store overlooking it. And then he comes down to share. It's like Moses when he went up to get the Ten Commandments and he came down to share it with the people. But all of that, man, I'm thankful that you notice all that. But all of that is very intentional.
Not only intentional, but I think subliminal, because I shouldn't say subliminal, but certainly subtextual, because it's a movie that, like you're saying, has a universal appeal to it. But also, for those of us of color who've grown up going into those kinds of churches and seeing that kind of message, because even the musical numbers are in their way about faith. And I'm just thinking about Gustafson's kind of number about almost fake faith. He's almost more like a televangelist in a way. And it's these wars of faith to me are kind of what the film's about in a lot of ways. Am I mistaken in thinking that?
No, you're not. Jeronicus's journey is the journey of Job, who had everything and had it taken from him. But at the end of Job's journey, he got everything back sevenfold, tenfold. I haven't been in church in obviously 30 years, so I don't know. But I'm not that religious. And at the end, where Jeronicus, Felicia Rashad's character, says, and everything that was ever stolen from him was returned. One of my favorite lines is never be afraid when people don't see what you see, only be afraid if you no longer see it. And it's that ability to that faith. And that's from, you know, faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. It's this man trying to find his faith again, which is belief, and find his way through having faith in himself, having faith in what he has created, having faith in what he was created to be and do. And so all of that, you know, I don't lead. I'm not a religious guy and I don't lead with that. But I do believe in Aesop fables and stories and those things that have a lesson and a greater meaning behind them.
There's so much about the pleasure of faith that we see through the kids and through the women for the most part in this piece too.
I think we're born with belief. We're born with faith. We're born with courage. We're born with fearlessness. And then we're taught then to be afraid. We're born with inclusiveness. We're taught that, well, this is for one group. This is for another group. And we're born with that belief in us. We're taught to question things and not believe. And I think a lot of the journey of a child, the journey literally of the character journey, Madeline Mills, she has not allowed herself to be taught to not be everything she was created to be. And she has to infuse that same sense into Jeronicus so that he can remember who he was. And I may be getting a bit Deepak Chopra-ish and bit Agape House. but it is so.
No, but all these things we're talking about, these are basically about pursuits of faith. And to do this in a way that's spiritual and secular, but also about the pleasures of that kind of faith can offer, baked into, you know, the crust of an entertaining Christmas story, that was a lot to try to pull off. We were going to take a break. My guest, who clearly wants us to do a lot of thinking about his work, especially in his new film, Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey, is David E. Talbert. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Seen on the Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Seen on the Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back. We're talking faith on The Treatment. My guest is a man who got Forrest Whitaker to sing in his new film, Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey, writer-director David E. Talbert. And Jeronica's Jangle, as an adult, was played by Forrest. And I guess what's fun about watching that is it's like he, in the weird way, he goes from being Buddy Love to Julius Kelp. I mean, when we meet him as the adult Jeronica, he can't even hold his head up. And I want to talk to you about that character conception, too, because, again, it's like you've taken almost all the popular culture and baked it into this one thing.
Forrest, of course, is a student of everything good, everything classic. We talked a lot about how he asked me how I saw Jeronica's Jangle and what did I pull from. And I told him it was a mix of Jimmy Stewart and It's a Wonderful Life, questioning his purpose or existence. It was a bit of Albert Finney and Ebenezer Scrooge, and it was a bit of Gene Wilder and Willy Wonka, and a mix of Dick Van Dyke, Caradocus Potts, and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Yeah, it was a kind of mix of those characters, if you put it in one. But Forrest made a bold choice as an actor. He was going to withhold joy from you. It was risky because he could have alienated the audience, but he held back joy so that when the character, as it evolved and the story evolved, and he gave you joy, you felt like, yes, you know, his smile, you smile, and he lit up the screen. And that is just a reminder that he's a master of his craft, and he's not afraid to take risks, and it paid big dividends for him in the film, because when he did smile, he lit up that screen. He lit up the world.
And it's funny too, because he goes from basically as a younger Jeronica, from being like an adult to, after he's lost so much, he's retreated into being a child again in a lot of ways.
When, you know, Jeronicus is me in many ways, where the Buddy 3000 was sitting up in his attic, this script was sitting in the attic of my hard drive for 20 years.
And for 20 years?
For 20 years. I started writing it in 97. Like the robot, the script always worked. And like Jeronicus' journey needed to come, my son needed to be born. Because when my son was born, man, I began to see the world through his eyes, and then I began to see it through mine again. And he reminded me of that innocence and that purity. You know, I relate so much to this character, and I think a lot of adults can, because it's beaten out of us, the joy, the exuberance, the innocence, the magic through life and just a course of living and being an adult. It's beaten out of you. You're always told you got to grow up. Well, damn it, I don't ever want to grow up.
In a lot of ways, in watching this, and that's what I'm saying, there's so much going on, and it felt almost like this metaphor for being in the entertainment business, where you have this thing that you love, that you've worked on, that means something to you, and having it go out into the world and the way people greet it, and losing relationships in that business. It felt weirdly like a metaphor for that, that was probably in some ways, again, conflated by your starting a family and then seeing that, having that innocence and joy come back, because you can lose a lot of that in chasing projects around, like you're saying, having this script in your hard drive in your attic for over 20 years. I mean, in some ways, it reminded me of Big Night in that way, where it's a metaphor about the relationship that you have to something that means something to you, and you can lose faith in that, and it takes somebody else to help you see that again.
He should get a credit for written and directed by. He should get inspired by. When I was shown the original design for the Buddy 3000, I showed it to him. He was 4 at the time. And I said, what do you think, you know, Elias? And he says, I like it, Daddy. And he says, what can he do? And I said, well, he can walk and he can talk. And I thought I was really saying something that impressed him. And he says, well, can he fly, Daddy? And I hadn't written that in the script for him to fly. And I said, yeah, he can fly. He just lit up. He asked me a question, and it makes me emotional every time. He looked at me and said, Daddy, can I fly? And I looked at him as 4-year-old boy looking at his daddy, asking him, can he fly? And I said, yes, son, you can fly too. And he lit up, his eyes sparkled. And that's when I made the robot make the characters fly. And that's really what, you know, at the end of the day, man, that's everything to me. It's everything to every parent. Every parent wants their children to see themselves bigger than society may, or bigger than they may even see. They want their children to soar and their imagination to fly. And for me, to be able to give this to my son and to people around the world of color, that's everything.
It's the treatment we're talking about, Black People Taking Flight, with my guest, David E. Talbert, whose new project for Netflix is Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey. And it's so funny as you're talking about this, because I think about Gustafson's piece, which is trying to fly and can't. And I think about how earthbound Don Juan Diego is. And there's almost a jealousy that comes out of that, isn't there? I mean, this one toy that Jeronica's designed that can't fly. As we're talking about this, I can feel that. And that must be part of the design, if you pardon me for using that word, as well, of that character who's also like Jiminy Cricket with no conscience, who preys on Gustafson as well.
and Ricky Barton, I mean, to create Don Juan, that the puppet has become the puppet master, because it just feeds. It's got hot coals and throws it into the fire and feeds that fire of ego and opulence. And he controls him by his ego. It's one of the moments that touches me a lot in this film, is when at the very end, when they're about to arrest Gustafson, take him out, drag him out of the store, Jeronica says, "Wait, stop, I have something for him." And he gives him a gift 30 years. This is a man who stole his empire and caused his life to spiral, but he has a bit of humanity left in him, to give him this gift. And gives him the gift that would have made that toy that he had 30 years ago work. And he says to him, "I would have shown you everything if only you'd waited."
That's what I'm saying. He goes from being like a full-bodied man at the very beginning, where he's got everything, to losing that. And then he becomes a child again. And then by the end of the story, he's that guy he was at the beginning. He's an adult who's capable of generosity, who's been kind of lifted out of this self-absorption into seeing the whole world around him, and a capable of joy again, which is, I don't want to give too much away, although we've given some stuff away, but there's a lot of texture in Jingle Jangle that we haven't given away. And that comes from the women, be it Mrs. Johnston or the narrator or his granddaughter Journey or his wife. I mean, it's also about not being complete. That's why I was thinking again about Almost Christmas, because it was a broken family that had to come together to complete itself.
What I love so much about even Almost Christmas is that this is a man's journey. He wanted to reconnect with his wife who had passed. And if he could figure out a way to make this sweet potato pie like she made it, he would have a piece of her back. And that's what that whole movie was about. It was a man's journey to reconnect to the love of his life once she had passed. And he did this through this pie and through his family. And
through tinkering, in the same way Jeronicus does.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he finally figured out the invention. He finally figured out that pie at the end. And it was, I mean, you could hear a pin drop in that theater when he finally took a bite of it, and it tasted like his wife. I use all the stories that I tell. They're all personal. My great-grandmother, Annie Mae Woods, made the best sweet potato pie on the planet. And when she passed, the year she passed, my mother said she was going to make Ma's sweet potato pies. We couldn't wait. And so she served it, and it didn't taste nothing like it. And for me, I had spent a lot of my adult life after my great grandmother passed, traveling all parts of this country to somebody who makes a sweet potato pie like Ma did. So that was personal for me too. And when that character played masterfully by Danny Glover was able to find it, that taste, that feeling again, it was a full circle moment for me.
This fascinates me because we can really see in your movies, we can even go back to First Sunday, which is another story about that takes place in a home of faith where people are fighting cynicism and trying to, not literal, actually, yeah, there's a family that's broken apart that has to rejoin, this broken family. And this idea of looking for this one thing, and it's never material success, even though there's often a character in your pieces who's looking for that. It's never that. It's always about basically coming back home to who you are.
And the concept in First Sunday was all people that people we consider good don't always do good things, and people that we look at as bad don't always do bad things, or people that do bad things aren't always bad people, and people that do good things aren't always good people. And so it's trying to kind of shake the tree on that and just look at people, try to look past what we perceive them to be. So, you know, all these are kind of things that you learn growing up in the church from me, and I try to apply it to my work.
I guess I have to say I was really moved to in Jingle Jangle by, and sort of the big emotional moments are all done with puppets. You know, Jeronica's losing his family. These big emotional moments are not done with people, but with puppets, which is a really interesting idea. And I wanted to ask you about that, how that came to you before we go.
So my wife, it was, I'm a grown ass man, and my wife says, let's go see animation. And I said, Len, I don't want to go see this animation. She says, I hear it's good. Let's go see it. So, you know, anyone who's married knows that there's no winning if your wife wants to do something. The resistance is futile. So I went there to sit down, and I got an attitude because I'm like, I could be doing so many other things. And the movie started at the beginning, and there's no dialogue. And I see this beautiful, happy family, and I see the wife pass away by the end of the opening. And I'm sitting there staring, and I'm in my feelings. I'm trying to act like the sneaker wiping away a tear. And I'm like, now, why would they do that to me? I came here to see a good movie. Why would you do this to me? And by the time I got through that damn movie and that man found his way back to joy, I said, that's one of the best movies I've ever seen in my life. So when it came time for the storybook sequences, I wanted to, in this mixed media, I wanted to be able to show emotion and tug on your heartstrings through these computer generated images, full CGI world. But I wanted to, in the narrative, go after how they got me and up. And somebody said to me, one of the best things they said to me was, somebody said to me, now, why would you do that to me, Dave Talbert? You know, why would you do that? But I wanted them to feel something, and they appreciated it. And so that was kind of an homage to masterfully what Pixar did and how you can really, really tug on heartstrings through animation.
Well, we're out of time, Dave. I can't thank you enough for doing this. And congratulations on a really great movie. Thank you so much for being here.
Black Elvis, it was my pleasure, brother.
That sounds, when you put it that way, it sounds like a horror movie, Black Elvis. A recording engineer at KCRW who also makes this a show is Kat. You're welcome back, Kat. The show is edited by Rebecca Mooney. I'm going to go get some sweet potato pie somewhere. To better days, everybody. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.